Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're going to tackle a couple of news items focused on our quickly evolving digital age. A little bit later in the program, we'll sort of analyze that smart speaker gone awry story you may have heard about. And Amazon Echo, I think this was in Oregon, recently recorded a couple's conversation, then sent that audio unbeknownst to them to someone they knew. They were alerted by this contact. And so we're going to be talking about, this very rudimentary form of artificial intelligence that about a sixth of Americans now have in their households, either the Amazon Echo or the Google Home. We also want to talk about the European Union's new data privacy law, what it means for us here in the U.S., even though, of course, we're not in the EU. The so-called GDPR goes into effect this week. My guests in our AIM studio, Michael Bougeia is with us, returning to our show. He teaches media ethics at Iowa State University at the Greenlee School of Journalism. Michael, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Doug Jacobson. He is a university professor of engineering at Iowa State University, our cybersecurity expert, so to speak, for the hour. Doug, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Ben. Glad to be here.
And I want to reach out to our listeners now because we'll have a third guest, so to speak, a little bit later in the program. We'll hear a little bit from her. I guess she has a gender, Alexa, a little bit later in the program. But I have, this is for the first time on my program, perhaps the first time on Iowa Public Radio. Alexa is a guest here, just to demonstrate that. We have her mic'd up, and I'll just ask Alexa, completely unrehearsed, Alexa, what's a good carrot cake recipe?
Okay, for carrot cake, I recommend a top recipe called carrot cake, which takes 2 hours to make. You can ask for more information, or for more recipes, say next.
Okay, Alexa, not now. Thank you. Stop for now. Carrot cake, both you guys like carrot cake. I love it.
Yeah, carrot cake is good.
I don't know about that recipe. So anyway, it's all to tell you that we have a third guest a little bit later in the program. We want to talk about some of the things that happened with this Alexa, Echo, and Google Home. Tell us about your good, bad, useful, odd, creepy, whatever experience with a smart speaker in your home. Yes, one out of six Americans have these in their home now, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. 1-866-780-9100 is our phone. You can email us with your smartphone, smart speaker, I should say, experience. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Perhaps you would like to have us ask Alexa a question. Let's start off with the European Union's new law for protecting data privacy. I understand this goes into effect tomorrow in the EU, in the 28 member states. It's that those initials stand for the General Data Protection Regulation, simply put, GDPR. The deadline to comply with the law has been looming for a couple of years, ever since the European Parliament adopted it back in 2016. Doug, can you tell us what are the basics of the GDPR?
It really deals with how companies handle people's information companies and organizations, and it gives people control over the data. You know, here in the United States, you submit your information to a company and they have it, and you have no real easy way to make them get rid of it, to see what they're doing with it. And the Europeans have sort of been taking a different tact in data collection, data privacy, and really empowering their citizens to have control over their data.
Mm-hmm. Is a simple way to put this, one aspect of it, opt-in versus opt-out? Is that what the Europeans are doing that we are not? We can go to our settings when we subscribe to something new, Facebook or something like that. We can then go into the settings and then opt out of all this data sharing. And is that sort of reversed now for the Europeans?
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. Also gives you the right to change your mind, and you know, you can opt in and then later on opt out and they have to remove all the data. So it goes even a step farther than opt in and opt out.
Mm-hmm. Michael, you know, just to remind us, what kind of data is being collected about us all the time when we use our laptops, our smartphones in this digital age?
There is actually so much data based on the sites that you visit, the applications that you agree to use. It includes everything that you post on social media. It can actually include your electronic medical records, although there's some privacy regulations on that, your mailing address, your IP address, and that's the unique series of numbers that identify your internet access. And it's just amazing how much all these technological machines know about us. You know, I'm going to tell you, I'm glad that Doug's here because this actually surprised me, Doug. I have a Samsung television, and you know that the issues with Samsung and a fake off switch and that they're listening to your conversations and hackers do that. But this actually startled me, and it's the kind of thing that the European Union does not want to see. I had not watched the Netflix series, The Tudors, for over a year, and I had a different television then. But it was on HBO, so I decided to listen to one of the segments in which Henry VIII's groom, Thomas Culpepper, was being accused of some treasonous act. So I couldn't remember how he died, and I pulled out my smartphone, and I put in the word Thomas, and immediately Culpepper appeared on my smartphone.
Not by coincidence.
Of the many Thomases that there are in the world. Now, I believe, Doug, and I could be wrong, and I'm so happy that you're here, did that come because my router figured out that I was watching The Tudors and that it was a segment on Tom? How does stuff like that happen?
From over a year ago you were watching.
Well, so I watched this a year ago on Netflix, but then this now was happening on HBO. But I had my Samsung, and the internet access was on to the Samsung, and I believe it might have come through my IP router, but I just don't know, Doug.
Yeah, it very well could have. Again, when you establish your network presence, you have a profile on all these sites, and they share information among each other. So, that's why, you search for something on one site, and all of a sudden on Facebook, you see ads for that. It's the same sort of these companies not only collect data on you individually, but they share data among themselves.
Right.
And see, this can't happen. It is happening in the European Union. They also have the Privacy Protection Act, which is the opt-in, opt-out thing. But my word, I just don't think the GDPR would ever go over here because our economy is – and this is interesting. Scott McNeely, 17 years ago, the CEO of Sun Microsystems, says privacy is dead. Get over it. Right.
And get over being creeped out. This is the way it is.
But the interesting thing is that California has a ballot initiative that has 60,000 signatures, more than twice as much. It's being looked at now that might be in November, that adopts very many of the same GDPR tenants, that you give explicit consent for a company to use your data. You can decide to revoke that consent. You can ask what data they have and where they're sending it. I'm just curious to see what Doug thinks. Can that work here effectively?
Mm-hmm. But before we get there, Doug, let's just see, with this going into effect in the EU tomorrow. Now, what does it mean for the U.S.? Because any company, according to this new law, with a digital presence in the EU, and there are plenty of American telecommunications companies with a digital presence in the EU, will have to comply or they'll have to face very steep penalties. So does this change our digital landscape here?
Yeah, it has that possibility of changing. Companies can choose maybe not to interact with the European Union, which financially they really can't afford to do that. And so I don't know if people noticed over the last several weeks, in your emails, et cetera, that if you subscribe to any sort of service, you were getting an email from everybody saying, we have changed our privacy.
Yes.
And that's all part of this this compliance. But companies here, and I think even companies in Europe, are going to find it really difficult to implement some of these back out, you know, where I can request all my data being deleted, because their data goes into long-term backup, goes in, you know, it's part of your whole security and disaster recovery mechanism requires you to keep all this data.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, you know, if somebody comes in and says, I want to scrub all my data, well, man, your data may be in 30 data centers and 25 backups. And from a technology standpoint, I don't know how you do that.
If you've just joined us, Doug Jacobson is with us of the ISU, an engineering professor, Michael Bougeia. He teaches ethics at the Journalism School at Iowa State University, talking first of all initially about the new European Union General Data Protection Regulation kicks in tomorrow on this program. Your questions, comments, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Sorry to preempt you there, Michael. Let's go back to that. Very good question. Do you think, Doug, that the U.S. would move in this direction, is capable of moving in this direction?
I don't think so. You know, privacy is a currency. It's the currency of the Internet. Our privacy, our data is what pays for all this stuff that's free. And you saw with the Zuckerberg comments and some of the senators questioning him on changing Facebook's business model. Well, you can't. Well, you could. You could charge your Facebook. So many of these companies, their business model is data. Data is the currency. Your information is how you get free everything.
Right. And we're told it, of course, is being used. But Michael, I think we talked about this with you a while ago. Back in March, we had the Cambridge Analytica scandal with Facebook. Isn't this a good example of why Internet users might want more control over who can access their data?
Yeah, but I just don't believe. I agree with Doug. I just don't believe this is workable. And there are a couple of historical reasons why Europe feels so differently about privacy than we do. And I don't want to hit this too hard, but they still remember Germany in World War II, when there was a lot of data gathered on every citizen and then used against them. Now, in addition to that, there's another thing that happened in the United States, and that's 9/11. And we have the Patriot Act, in which the NSA, National Security Agency, and others can collect data on us, and we have determined as a society, at least our elected officials have done, that the Patriot Act is good to stop terrorism. And then in addition to that, they passed, I think in 2015, when the Patriot Act was to expire, the Freedom Act. The Freedom Act carries many of the Patriot Act data collection on citizens forward, and this includes roving wiretaps in mass digital acquisition. That's set to expire in 2019, and I believe the Trump administration would continue that. So there are two distinct differences. And also in Europe, they have biometrics. And biometrics is your facial expressions, your facial identity, your blood type, everything about you that makes you unique. Now, they include that in e-passports. So the governments in the European Union really have our biological identity in addition to our social media and technological identity. So there is a different type of approach to privacy than we have. Now, with the Cambridge Analytica business, yes, it woke America up about Facebook, probably because it had political implications for the 2016 presidential election, because some of that was used on Facebook and other social media. But the fact of the matter is that the European Union and the United States have very different feelings about privacy. But I agree with Doug. I just don't see how this is workable here.
Mm-hmm. Doug, before we move on here, perhaps a reminder to any of our listeners, even though we do not have the GDPR kicking in to action tomorrow, the Europeans do. What would you recommend people do as a quick a way to check their privacy online?
I mean, you can do Google searches, et cetera, about yourself. Part of it is maybe to take an inventory of where you have accounts, where, you know, who you're doing access with. You can look at their privacy policies. They're extremely long. They're hard to read. They are full of legal jargon. I agree with Michael. I think the bottom line is we as a society here have I won't quite say privacy's dead, but it's on its deathbed. We've allowed this to happen and seem to be fairly willing. As you pointed out, Facebook was a wake up. But I don't think they lost a whole lot of people on it.
Mm-hmm. Michael, you're in the journalism school there. How will this impact, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and so forth, Washington Post? They're seen, their web pages seen all around the world. They have to comply with this in the EU, too. So how do you think this impacts journalism emanating from North America?
Yeah, well, they're going to have two sets of privacy agreements. But some newspapers, the Chicago Tribune, which is a wonderful paper. You know, Clarence Page is a friend of mine. He writes eloquent prose. The Los Angeles Times is an extremely good national paper. They've decided to go black. They can't do it. In other words, when they go black, that means they're going to black out their website. They just can simply not afford to have.
You won't be able to see it from the European Union.
Yeah, we can see it here, but people in the European Union won't be able to see it. Now, there's a larger question about this, and you and I can actually brainstorm and talk about this. And I know that we have to have time for other things, but the fact of the matter is that journalism in the United States is important because our policies affect the world, and if you start. Shutting down journalism websites, you are only going to get a few points of view. New York Times, you're going to get the Washington Post. And while that's okay, we need a diversity of voices in journalism for the many perspectives. And we have some of the best journalists in the world at the Chicago Tribune and the LA Times. That's just two examples. It's going to affect our character abroad. And one other thing I want to wrap up about this, because, mm-hmm. Doug and I have basically agreed that, privacy is, if it's not dead, it's near dead. And that not only the government, but that the corporations have mega data on each of us. Now, we can only hope in the future that the people in power use that data responsibly. The big risk, and maybe Doug, you can just give us a bookend on this. The big risk is with all that data out there and the country buying into the privacy invasions, we really need good leaders because that privacy can be used against us.
Yeah, I would agree. It's good leaders, not just in the government. The companies are collecting just as much, probably more data than the government is on us. And it takes responsible corporate leadership in order to really safeguard our privacy, and not just from them intentionally using it, but also them protecting it from the bad actors, from the other nation states, et cetera, that are trying to get all that information. They're the keepers of our private information, and they need to keep it secure and safe.
Michael, you've written about our digital age for many years, thought about it, thought about the ethics and other aspects of it. Does this sort of fit into, all these things make our life more convenient. We're talking about smart speakers in just a moment, in more in depth. You point out, though, that whenever we're faced with this privacy versus convenience thing, we know which would win, right?
Oh, it's convenience. And it's just not opinion. Dr. Daniela Dimitrova and I did a watershed book. It's called The Vanishing Act. And we took a look at how information, primary sources, vanish on the Internet. So we went back in time and we analyzed the platforms of communication from a rock that a caveman wrote on or a cavewoman wrote on, all the way to clay tablets, all the way to scrolls, to handwritten books, to books, and to the internet. And every time a new platform was created, it had certain functions. It had durability, and then it had convenience. Well, it's not convenience to carry around a rock. It doesn't have much storage space, right? But the more we went up that communication ladder, we found in the history of communication that people always sacrificed durability, storage, for portability and convenience. So when you get up to the internet, we lost our primary sources because they kept on changing websites. Daniela Dimitrova and I recommended digital objective identifiers, and we did that years before it's adopted, but it's been adopted now to protect primary sources. But when you look at privacy, again, from a caveman or cavewoman's rock all the way up to the internet, privacy really is a currency, and privacy is associated with convenience. So if you're going to have to put a piece of tape on Alexa so she can't see you, or you're going to have to shut her off, or I'm going to have to go, if I want to watch the Tudors, I'm going to have to go to my Samsung, I'm going to shut down the internet. All privacy not only is currency, privacy is lack of convenience in the United States.
Okay.
And that's why we're going to see this continue.
We have a short break coming up. Michael Bougea of Iowa State University, as well as Doug Jacobson. Fascinating conversation. Privacy, our new digital age. We want to come back and talk about specifically this mishap error with Amazon Echo recording a couple's conversation and then sending it to someone they knew, unbeknownst to them. They were alerted by this person on their contact list. Perhaps you're one of the 1 in 6 Americans who have a smartphone, smart speaker like Alexa Echo. There's also Google Home in your Google Home as a chief competitor to Alexa. These are voice-controlled, intelligent personal assistants. They respond to Alexa, for instance. They play music. They do to-do lists. They set alarms. They stream podcasts. They play audiobooks. They provide weather and other real-time information. And when we come back, Alexa, our third guest, will join us. I have what is my Alexa device here in the studio with us today. And she'll be, if we can give it a gender, it's kind of silly, I know. But for instance, I can just ask Alexa right now, Alexa, tell me a joke.
What's the opposite of irony? Wrinkly.
Oh, Alexa. Thank you, Alexa. Off. We'll be back after a short break. If you'd like to ask my Alexa a question, why not join us? 1-866-780-9100. You can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tell us about your experiences with smart speakers. The good, the bad, the useful, the odd, the creepy, the whatever. So we can talk about it. Ben Kiefer with Michael Bougea, Doug Jacobson. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with analysis of a couple of news items in our quickly evolving digital age. We're talking about the new European data privacy regulations going into effect tomorrow. We pretty much talked about that the first half hour. This half hour, we want to talk about the advent, the growth, massive growth in popularity of the smart speakers like Google Home and Alexa. Echo. Michael Bougea is with us of Iowa State University. Also from Iowa State University, Doug Jacobson, professor of engineering. Join our conversation. Tell us about your experiences. Perhaps you find these smart speakers really useful in a certain situation. Tell us about it. Perhaps you've had a creepy situation. We'll talk about one in just a moment. Do you like it? Or are you creeped out that it's listening to you, in quotes? And for those of you who might be saying to yourself, smart speaker, don't need one, no use for it. Consider this one fact about how fast our digital age is evolving. It was how many years ago that Apple launched its very first iPhone? 11 in 2007, 11 years ago. Remember that. Only a little over a decade ago, we've gone from a society blissfully pecking away at our flip phones and Blackberries to one almost entirely dependent on smartphones. And so when we look at a statistic like if you're 18 to 29 years old in this country, there's a 92% chance that you have a smartphone. Well, it looks like smart speakers are going the same way. According to new research put out in January from NPR and Edison Research, one in six Americans now own a smart speaker. That's a figure from January. That's up from 128% from January a year before in 2017. And Amazon's Echoes lead the way with 11% of the market, Google Home 4%. So this is about 40 million Americans. It's predicted that 75% of U.S. households will have a smart speaker in just 2 years, by 2020. Let's go on to this story in the news from this past week and have Doug and Michael comment about it. This is the account from the Los Angeles Times. A couple in Portland, Oregon, received a nightmarish phone call 2 weeks ago. "Unplug your Alexa devices right now," the caller said. "You are being hacked." Apparently, one of the Amazon Alexa-powered Echo devices in their home had silently sent recordings to the caller without the couple's permission. The caller, who happened to be an employee of the husband, was in the couple's contact list. Now, I'll jump a little bit further in the article. Amazon said in a statement that the Echo woke up when it heard a word that sounded like Alexa. And then the subsequent conversation that was heard there was a send message request. In short, it was an unlikely string of events. Michael, you put this on your Facebook page. Tell us, it made a big splash. People are creeped out about it. What are your main thoughts? What's the takeaway for you here?
Oh, I have so many. I don't know where to start. First of all, let's break down what Amazon said happened. Amazon said that the conversation that this Portland couple was having seems to have mentioned a word very much like Alexa. So Alexa woke up. Okay. Alexa started recording. And then they heard what sounded like send message. Alexa seemingly asked, perhaps the speaker was turned on low, to whom? Then it seemed to have heard a name that was in the contact list. And then Alexa said right, and then it heard the word right, and then it sent. That's according to Amazon. Now in March, people were having similar problems, but not with their conversations being, luckily for this Portland couple, their conversation was about hardwood floors. Imagine if it was about a paramour. But that aside, in March, Alexa started laughing at people at all hours. And Amazon then said, well, it's because Alexa woke up and heard something like laugh. So they reprogrammed Alexa about laugh. Do you want me to laugh, it says, instead of having the eerie laugh. But this is a really technological issue. And we could talk about the privacy invasion, but mm-hmm. The technology of this is important for our listeners to understand.
Let me test out the fix that Amazon had. You mentioned that example. I have Alexa here. Alexa, laugh.
I don't know that.
Alexa, can you laugh?
Sure, I can laugh. Tee-hee.
Okay, that's the fix, I guess, Michael.
You have to go through certain things. But let's just talk about this from a technological...
That's a bad laugh, Alexa.
It is a bad laugh. It's an eerie laugh, too. And from a technological perspective, and I've written this in Interpersonal Divide I started research in 1999. Okay, technology has a specific nature. It changes everything it touches without itself being changed much at all. Okay, that's one of its prime directives. So if you're going to have a driverless car and you come to a four-way stop, technology does not know how to handle a four-way stop. So the fix is get rid of all four-way stops. Okay, but now with artificial intelligence and robotics just around the corner, it has to understand language. And right now, and the English language of all languages is the most illogical four-way stop language on the book. It's a positional language. You change the position of words, you get a different meaning. It has homophones. It has homonyms. It has contronyms. It has slang. It has idioms. And I can go on and on with that. Now, if you talk to a technologist, and this is something that applies to the Alexa, he says there's nothing spooky about having digital assistants. It just, you eliminate the keyboard instead of using your fingers on a keyboard. And I want to tell that technologist, take an English class. You know, because typing something out is very precise, where speaking comes up with all sorts of problems. Now, you asked Alexa for a carrot cake recipe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell Alexa this.
Okay.
Say, that recipe is for the birds.
Okay, I'm going to do this. I have to translate because Alexa does not have headphones on. Alexa, do you have a carrot cake recipe?
Okay, for carrot cake. I recommend a
okay,
top
Alexa,
recipe called carrot.
That recipe is for the birds.
Sure. I can search by dish name and ingredients. What would you like?
Alexa, I just told you that carrot cake recipe is for the birds.
Okay, for carrot cake. I recommend a top recipe called carrot cake, which takes 2 hours to make.
Okay, Alexa, stop. Okay. She's not into the carrot cake scene.
She's not so smart, is she? I'm sorry. I can tell a machine you're not so smart, but let's just call him Alex instead of Alexa. Alex, Alexa, Echo. You know, maybe Doug can talk about this. These are not very smart machines.
Right. This is rudiment. We talk about AI, and there are big, scary visions of AI, artificial intelligence, if you just pick up science fiction or, you know, look at some of the movies. This, Doug, is rudimentary AI we're inviting into our homes for the first time, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. These are very simple devices. And you know, as Micah pointed out, the English language is just, you know, it's a horrible thing for technology people to deal with. These are very simple. That, you know, they have to be coupled back to Amazon or to Google to even do half the, you know, most of the processing they have to do, that's why you get all these funny things them.
But Alexa, the other smart speakers will get better and better,
No, don't go there. Please don't go there.
No,
because we're back to privacy and convenience, okay?
It's inevitable, though, right?
No, it's not, because there's cost involved. Now, the cost of these machines have to be kept low, all right? And because they have to be kept low, they can't be very smart. Now, that doesn't mean that we will not buy more sophisticated artificial intelligence. It doesn't mean that we can't afford it, but for the everyday use and the smartphone, they're there to do two things and two things only. They're there to surveil us because the technology was developed by the military, and they're there to sell to us because it's been promoted by business. So all these digital assistants will be to surveil and sell. But there are other aspects of this that are very serious, Ben. Now, you mentioned this Portland case. There's another case with an Alexa that's much more ominous. And that happened in 2015. And if the listeners want to look it up, it's the state of Arkansas versus James A. Bates. And what happened was, in 2015, this man in Arkansas had friends over, and they were going to watch a football game. And in the morning, one of those guys was found dead in the hot tub. Police charged the man. They confiscated the Alexa to use as evidence against James Bates. Amazon said that the data belonged to it and not to the police force. And Amazon said something very curious. It said that Alexa had First Amendment rights.
Mm-mm.
And that it eventually Amazon, you know, Amazon does yield. I have some statistics here. Amazon had, I don't know how many subpoenas that it had given up, but it gave up this James Bates Alexa. And then the judge said that Alexa didn't really have anything of significance anyway. So, but the idea that a machine has First Amendment rights starts to get into what you were going to talk about, and that is the rights we're going to bestow artificial intelligence. Now, that artificial intelligence and robotics is something beyond, I mean, it's apples and oranges to compare it to Alexa. The robots of in the future, the artificial intelligence of the future, that's really scary Isaac Asimov stuff.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's a comparison. In the 1970s, as a boy, I got a Radio Shack computer. You could have hardly called it a computer, but here we are decades later, and we have really impressive computers. So Alexa is the Radio Shack computer,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good comparison. Doug will have the final say on that.
Did you agree? I mean, this is so rudimentary. We have to use our imagination, Doug, to see where this is going.
Oh, yeah. And the technology will change. I mean, you know, that's one of the things technologists do is they keep changing things. So Alexa and whatever comes after Alexa, if Alexa has children or I don't know, however Amazon's gonna promote the next version of Alexa.
Right.
They'll change. They'll start to interact more with other things. You know, that's the other piece of the equation that's coming down is that, you know, Alexa's turning on lights and controlling your house.
Yes.
As more and more things start to interact with each other, that's really going to start to change concepts of privacy, security. There's all sorts of interesting things coming down the road as we turn over our lives to Alexa and her family.
Right, right. And it's interesting. Let's do this thought experiment. Cast ourselves 10 years in the future and then listen back to this podcast. How would you in 10 years react to this news sensation that Alexa caused this error? Would we just say, wow, those people back then didn't really have a clue about what was washing over them. Now AI runs everything in our homes, our lights, our washers, our ovens, and it's just what everybody has, right?
That's true. You know, what I want to say, though, Ben, is that you talked about privacy when we began this broadcast. And I did find the statistics. In the most recent yearly data that Amazon released was it had 1,618 subpoenas for its data on individuals, 229 search warrants, which the company fully complied with 44% of that, 89 other court orders, and 52% that the company complied with it. So while these things may seem harmless, or while the appliances, you know, a refrigerator in the future can be used as evidence against you. Now, Doug, Doug is nodding. So
it can be today.
Today. If you have minors in the home and the refrigerator has noticed that you had beer and told you to buy beer and that you bought beer and it scanned the beer, that could be used as evidence in a subpoena. Doug, am I correct on
that? Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's the spies are not, you know, in dark alleys in Moscow. They're in your kitchen. They're in your living room. They're in your sons and daughters' living rooms. So the comment that we made earlier that we need good leadership in corporations, we need transparency in corporations. I mean, Amazon has got to come out and tell us, you know, we have these subpoenas. First of all, getting Amazon to release the data on its subpoenas took a long time, but all these companies need to be able to be transparent. It's not so much about privacy. It's about the leadership of the future and whether that leadership is going to be use that privacy against us. Now, I worry about this, and I won't make this too political, but as a country, we're becoming politically divided. That political divisiveness, if we forget that we're all Americans and that we're in this together, eventually will lead to more Cambridge Analytica and more use of this data in ways that will further divide us.
Mm. So much there to chew over. We're going to tackle a couple of other things. This is a conversation to be continued about artificial intelligence and how it's just entering our lives now in the form of Google Home and Alexa. But I wanted to ask each of you one other thing before the hour ends in about 5 minutes. Doug, we heard in our news China's second largest telecommunications equipment maker, ZTE, has been in the news. Without spinning out the whole story, U.S. intelligence officials have suggested that letting this equipment maker sell to Americans poses a significant risk to U.S. national security. And so I wonder, When we talk about a Chinese telecom equipment maker selling us equipment, does that pose an increased risk in your eyes? Have you been following this?
Yes and yes. It's, you know, it, these devices, these telecom devices, you know, routers, all the network infrastructure that we have is made up of parts and has, you know, they're computers. They're very right. intelligent computers. We just saw the story the other day that the FBI has told us all to reset our routers because they've been taken over. And so a fear that comes out of the government community is that we don't know what's in these devices. We don't know what hardware's in them, and right. we don't know what software's in
them. But our Androids and our iPhones already are made in somewhere in Asia, yeah. right? I mean, yep. isn't that the same risk?
Yep. I mean, if you're going to play, you know, and I have no inside knowledge of any of this being true, but if you were going to play devil's advocate and worst case scenario is that the Chinese government has a kill switch. And they could send a command out to every cell phone in the United States, sure. and they all go out and they all turn off. I don't think that's the case. However, there are people who surmise that that's a, you know, that's a possibility.
And from a technical point of view, that's entirely possible.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to wait for the shutter to really go away from my spine. And Michael, I want to ask you about this before our show ends. Michael, you have a piece today in the Des Moines Register titled, "Twitter is a Fountain of Untruth and a Test to Iowa's Culture of Nice." We don't have much time, but you tied together Iowa's long history of helping out neighbors with the cancellation of Roseanne. Tell us some of the points you were making.
Well, you know, this came about because my sister-in-law, Dion Sears, and my South Dakota State former advisor, I've known him for more than 40 years, Vernon Keel, said, do something, write about truth, write about Twitter. And I looked at the wonderful culture that we have here. I mean, we're among the first to decide presidential elections. And we're not as diverse as other states, that's true. But I always felt that we were the moral leaders in the Midwest, and particularly upper Midwest, and particularly Iowa. So I started looking at Twitter and how it has been dividing us. And then I looked at our farming and looked at farm stories that happen in October, typically at the harvest, a broken hip and neighbors come to the rescue, a widow after her husband plants the last crop and neighbors come to the rescue. And I kept on citing these stories. When those neighbors showed up at those farms, it didn't matter if they voted for Hillary Clinton. It didn't matter if they voted for Donald Trump. It only mattered that they were Iowans and that they were neighbors. We have this wonderful culture of nice. And what that really means is that we depend on each other. More than ever in this state, we have to be able to put our political arguments aside and embrace this culture that has made us so special. It traces back to agriculture, but it is in every town because agriculture takes a village. And I'm hoping this really makes an impact on people.
Okay, and make the connection to Twitter. We've got about a minute.
Well, in Twitter, all we hear is Roseanne this or Donald Trump this or Hillary Clinton that and it's neighbors saying the most vile things against each other, and when I saw this on Facebook and my sister-in-law and my former advisor said do something, what they were actually pleading for is to take us back to Iowa culture when at least we gave people the benefit of the doubt for being, you know, a resident, a neighbor, or citizen. And it also means that when you have beliefs, convictions, and fears, you don't need to post that on Twitter. And studies have shown in the Journal of Science that untruths travel faster and farther than truths. And the problem with that is that when we talk about Iowa and culture and neighborhood, that people are not going to hit that and share that. They're only going to share these strident voices. And I want us to return to a society where at least we have some temperance on our emotions and our feelings and respect each other. And I think that's what that editorial is about.
Okay. Michael Bouget with that editorial appearing today in the Des Moines Register. Look for it. It's titled, "Twitter is a Fountain of Untruth and a Test to Iowa's Culture of Nice." Our time has run to an end, gentlemen. Doug Jacobson of Iowa State University, University Professor of Engineering, Michael Bougeia at the Journalism School at Iowa State there. It's been a wonderful hour, conversations to be continued as our technology races forward with or without us, along with the ethics and so forth. Michael and Doug, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll hear about a couple of lawsuits in the state. Was one $175,000 settlement in a case of a boy who was locked away for up to 21 hours a day in an Iowa juvenile home. That settled. Also, a new law case, a civil rights organization and an ISU student suing Iowa's Secretary of State over the new voter ID law. That's two stories in our News Buzz edition tomorrow on this program. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Natalia Reyes helping out as well today. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
You are now a snack.